It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
Southern West Virginia, this area, these woods where we're standing at right now is one of the most biologically diverse places on the entire planet. And you look out at a mine site like that and you see how bare that is. Like, that's never, ever going to support the type of ecosystems, the types of wildlife, the types of plants, everything else that a healthy Appalachian forest ecosystem should be able to support.
It's The Big Take from Bloomberg News and iHeartRadio. I'm Wes Kosova. Today, what happens when Big Coal decides to pack up and leave town? As America's long dependence on coal winds down, some companies that made fortunes in that industry are looking to move on. And they're leaving behind a big, filthy mess all across coal country. Ruined land and poisoned water that someone's got to pay to clean up. And that's when the game of pass the buck begins. So who does wind up footing the bill? Bloomberg reporters Zachary Miter and Josh Saul went to find out. They join me now from New York. Josh Saul, Zach Miter, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having us, Wes.
You tell your story in part through the eyes of retired miner. His name is Miles Hatfield, and he lives in eastern Kentucky. Can you tell us about him?
Sure. I first found Miles after a lawyer I was talking to suggested I look at complaints that were made around some of the specific mines that we were looking at. He describes a really sad story. He lived in the house where he raised his kids. They lived there for decades. And then the runoff from the Love Branch mine started affecting his home. The moment that really almost made me gasp is when he described a few years ago walking through his house and the water had weakened his floor and the structure under his house. And he was walking into his dining room and he fell through the floor. He fell through and got sort of pinned up to his hips.
I didn't know it was under the house until that fell in. And then there was no doubt about it then.
The Love Branch mine was a coal mine, an underground coal mine. So you can imagine just a deep shaft going into the ground. What happens with these kind of mines is they can change the hydrologic balance or change the way that the water flows underground. So above Miles' house, instead of the water flowing the way it had for decades, where it flowed, you know, to the sides of his house and down through natural creeks and underground caverns, it started flowing, you know, right through his yard and eventually under his house.
Miles Hatfield described what happened to him.
There wasn't no warning when it fell, but it went wall to wall. Kitchen cabinets, the lower kitchen cabinets, they're suspended in the air. The floor fell out from underneath those. This is in a bat of an eye. I was in 4 feet of water, which I didn't know was there until I went in it. I had a cell phone with me, no signal. It took me about 20 minutes to get out of the hole that I was in. The stuff that had fell in was floating in the water, and I kept stepping on things to try to push myself up. And it took me about, I'd say, 20 minutes just to get up out of the kitchen. And I went upstairs, told my wife, she couldn't believe it. She come down and where we did have a kitchen and dining room, didn't have it anymore. Now, you gotta use your imagination on the rest of it. As I went down, got electric stove, it hit me in the back of the head. So I was thinking, what, that'd be embarrassing to, if it was in the paper, a man drowns in kitchen, which I wouldn't know about it, but it's not exactly the way I'd want to go.
He said it felt like, you know, in an old cowboy movie when they hang a guy and he falls through the platform of the floor. You know, he said it felt like falling into a swimming pool. And it basically ruined his house. He had to move. He now lives a few miles away in a rental, which really burns him. He's very unhappy that, you know, he spent so much of his life. He actually worked as a coal miner before he retired and spent a lot of his life making money to pay off the mortgage on this house. And then now he's paying rent, you know, for a different house. He's pretty unhappy about that.
It cost $160 a month to run a pump to pump this water down. And I hope to make it back. I hope the house can be fixed, but we won't know until we empty it to see what we have inside.
And what happened to him is really what your story is all about, that this mine, no longer in use, is sitting there and it's causing all kinds of trouble, and it's supposed to get fixed. So just what happens when a mine closes down?
Yeah. So you might think like, okay, they're done with the coal, like whatever. They just kind of close up the entrance and that's it and everything's fine. But in reality, an old coal mine leaves a huge mess. And so one thing that very frequently happens is that because of the activity of pulling all the coal out, you sort of unearth all these noxious chemicals that are naturally occurring, but that would never cause a problem unless something like mining happened to sort of cause them to come out all at once. It's super common for the area around the coal to have like material that when water flows in there, water and air that were never there before, they essentially become highly acidic. And then the acid water picks up things like metals, like iron and aluminum, which is why the water that flows out of old mines is typically bright orange, or very often bright orange, because it's so laden with iron. And that's just kind of a signal that something's wrong, but it's the acidity that typically will kill any aquatic life or something that would want to live in it. So in Appalachia, there's thousands of miles of creeks and streams that are affected by what they call acid mine drainage. In addition to that, you have selenium, which is a necessary nutrient, but in high enough quantities, it could become toxic to birds and insects. And so in some parts of West Virginia and Kentucky, you have creeks that are also poisoned with that, and it's extremely difficult to get rid of. So just from the activity of digging things up, you have all these really profound problems. And then, of course, in addition, you have what Josh was talking about, which is the drainage of actually affecting people who live nearby. And you also have in mountaintop removal mining, you have just these giant piles of rock that are basically what's left of the mountain when it's been kind of blown up. You're actually just kind of blowing the top off a mountain and then kind of dumping it into the nearest valley. And so what you're left with is this, you know, where you, before you had a forest that had things growing on it, now you've just kind of like the surface of the moon or something.
So we all know that mining, and you do a great job of describing it, is dirty business. And so when mines are done, the mining companies are supposed to make it right. What are they supposed to do?
There's a federal law that mining companies have to, when they're done mining, when they're done taking coal out of the ground, they have to restore the land to its, roughly to its original contours, you know, so it has a similar or the same shape in terms of there was a mountain here and a valley here. They have to plant vegetation so that there are something growing there, and they have to make sure that there's not water runoff that is bad for people or animals or plants or wildlife that live nearby or downstream. So that's both making sure that the water's not running in some totally different way, like with flooding, and also that it's not poisoned or laden with chemicals.
You spoke to an advocate called Aaron Savage with a group called Appalachian Voices.
Right. Yeah.
Here's what she had to say about the process of reclamation.
After 1977, coal companies became legally required to reclaim the mines that they had started. The law passed to regulate coal mining is called the Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act. We commonly refer to it as SMCRA.
Some of it's simpler in terms of moving dirt around. That's at least like pretty easily understandable. And you can see when you're done that, okay, that's maybe not as pretty as it was before. But the water treatment, which Zach wrote about, is a really long-term and really a difficult thing.
When I was in West Virginia, I went out with some guys who try to keep track of the cleanup of all these acid mine drainage streams. And to give you a sense of the kind of long-term environmental consequences here, one of the places we went to, there was a stream that had been poisoned since the 1890s. And it was still acidic until just a couple years ago when the state finally got around to cleaning it up. And what they're doing, it turns out to be very expensive and long-term expensive, because if you think of it, it's basically, it's acid just like household vinegar. If you want to clean it up, you essentially just have to apply a base to neutralize it. And so what they do is they typically install these like giant silos along the stream with a machine that's kind of constantly dumping this limestone powder into the creek. And so that's expensive. It's like electricity and material that could easily be needed for another 100 years. And I went out with these guys to test some samples of the water and see how things were going. And one of them said, you know, if this machine were to break down for 24 hours, this whole stream is back to square one. Everything in it dies and we'll have to start over.
It's almost like the stream is on life support.
Yeah, it's depending on the machine.
But they have signs out with the road saying it is poison. They told the people in the hollow, don't let your kids play in it and don't let your animals drink from it. But this water goes to the river, they treat it down there, and they send it back to us as drinking water. I still don't know who posted a sign out there telling about the water, but if I put polluted water in the creek, I'm sure somebody be after me. Coal companies they're a little bit lax on holding them, you know, accountable.
And there are so many streams, you know, not just rivers, but streams that are anywhere from a flow to a trickle, that you can't put machinery on all of them.
Some of these decisions are kind of up to regulators' point of view, a regulator's decision. One longtime regulator I talked to, he actually ended up being Obama's head of mine reclamation. He said that when he was a young regulator in Pennsylvania, a guy he worked with had a unique method for deciding whether or not a stream was big enough or important enough to be protected. And he said if he could piss across it, that it wasn't big enough to warrant protection.
My conversation with Zachary Miter and Josh Saul continues after the break.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
That's got to be pretty expensive work to restore what has been upturned by mining for, you know, decades often.
The problem with SMACRA at this point is that the requirements for reclamation are unclear and there isn't enough money available to do the reclamation.
Aaron Savage has done some work to try to figure out how big this whole problem is of cleaning up Appalachian coal country. And she estimates that it's going to cost something like $8 or $10 billion to clean up all the mines that still have to be reclaimed. And then she went in and tried to figure out, well, how much money is available to do that? And it doesn't look good because there's some bond money set aside that these companies have to post, but it's not nearly as much as their obligations. And so if these companies fail, as a lot of them do, that difference is going to have to be borne by somebody else. And so it'll either be that the work doesn't get done and it's sort of borne by the environment, or it has to be paid for by, you know, state reclamation funds, which are sometimes funded by taxes on coal. So it's kind of funded by the industry. But if those run out, then ultimately it would be the taxpayers that would have to come up with a difference.
Are companies willing to at least try?
Companies often don't want to do the cleanup. It's hard. It's expensive. It takes a long time. It takes equipment away from the profitable activity of actually mining coal. So something that they prefer to do, and our reporting found often have been doing, is instead of cleaning up that land, they instead offload or transfer or sell those mining permits to another company, often to a smaller company that's willing to take on those cleanup obligations. They can do that by selling the mining permits, or they can also do that by basically giving the mining permits. And sometimes they do give along a substantial chunk of money so that the smaller company has some kind of resources to do the cleanup. But you have a situation where you have smaller companies with a lot fewer people, with less expertise, and they then suddenly have sometimes hundreds of mining permits that they're responsible for cleaning up. And we found that those companies have been, for the most part, at least in the main case that we looked at, not cleaning up many of the mines and also racking up huge numbers of environmental violations.
You read about one company in particular and how they did exactly what you're describing. Zach, can you tell about how that happened?
Alpha was one of the biggest coal companies in the country. Basically, the whole industry sort of went broke in the mid-2000s because of the collapsing demand for coal because of cheaper competition from natural gas. And so in the course of sort of working its way out of bankruptcy and just afterwards, Alpha undertook this transaction where they said, well, we have all these old coal mines in Appalachia that basically don't have any coal that's worth mining anymore. And so we're going to shift them to this small company that actually didn't have a lot going on at all until Alpha transferred all these mines to it. So hundreds of mining permits. And they handed over some money as well. And the plan was, you know, this company, Lexington, would essentially just be in the business of cleaning up all these old mines. That's what it was going to do.
This was the smaller company that took on all of these permits.
That's right. Yeah. And that ended up being a great deal for Alpha because, you know, is now a publicly traded company again. And they can tell their investors, look, we don't have this legacy obligation of uncertain costs that we'll be burdened with, you know, for a long time while all this cleanup happens. Instead, we can just focus on the future, focus on the mines we have now that are still operating with coal in them, and you don't have to worry about any of those old cleanup jobs.
These asset transfers and this strategy, this playbook, has been tremendously profitable for a lot of these companies. A number of these big coal companies have had record profits. Alpha specifically, its executives have earned tens of millions of dollars over, say, the past decade or so, and the company's stock is up something like 700%.
So Alpha is just one of several companies involved in mines that need to be cleaned up. The example you use with Alpha is just one example.
Absolutely, yeah.
And Alpha is just one of many coal companies that use the same playbook and effectively offloaded or passed off its cleanup obligations.
Which is all entirely legal because it's approved by state regulators.
That's right.
Now, why would Lexington, a smaller company, not a lot of assets, take over essentially spent mines and tons of obligations? What is the incentive for them?
I think there's two incentives for Lexington in a situation like that. The first is that some of the mines do have coal left in them, and coal can be mined profitably, especially when coal prices are high like they are right now.
To abstract away from Lexington to kind of all of these companies in general that are taking on these obligations, they don't necessarily have that much money in the game. In other words, they're taking on a huge amount of obligation, but if things go south and they fail, they haven't actually bet that much on that outcome. Whereas if it turns out to be less expensive, or if coal prices recover dramatically, some of those defunct mines become useful again, they kind of get all that upside.
Well, one thing that you describe in the story is that in some cases, these smaller companies don't have enough money, and then taxpayers wind up holding the bag.
Right. That's the thing, is that by transferring mines from a kind of big company with a lot of coal like Alpha to a smaller company that doesn't really have anything else going on, what you're doing is essentially guaranteeing that whoever's going to have to pay for that long term, it won't be Alpha.
Josh, what did Alpha and Lexington say when you asked them about this?
Alpha said that, you know, first of all, we're a very environmentally conscious company, and they say that they're proud of their standards. More specifically, they say that they often pass along substantial payments to the companies that take on their cleanup obligations. And they also say that all of these transfers are approved by state regulators. Lexington told me that they would comment, but never actually sent along any answers to any questions.
Josh, you mentioned the state regulators having to approve these deals, and that's exactly what happened in this case, right? Where they spelled out this plan, and the state regulators looked at it, and they did approve it. And what was in the plan?
plan was that Lexington would take on all the obligations. Lexington would do all the cleanup that Alpha had promised to do, even set aside money to do it. But it basically passed along money to Lexington. And Lexington at that point had all the obligations, and Alpha went on its way.
We haven't had a final accounting yet of how much money's actually left to clean this stuff up. But there's a lot of signs that it doesn't look great, because these mines, rather than being owned by these coal companies that are super profitable this year, are instead owned by these like little companies we can't even really tell if they're in business, or in some cases they've already gone bankrupt or put in receivership already. So they're sort of unable to benefit from the revival in the coal industry that we're seeing. So to take the kind of big picture perspective, you know, for 100 years in the coal industry, there were no rules about this. You could just dig a mine and then kind of walk away. And so the federal government to this day is, I mean, they just approved a big spending bill that would spend billions of dollars cleaning up those old messes from back before there were rules. We're still cleaning that up. Since 1977, there's been this federal law that says the coal companies have to clean it up, and there's all these kind of checks and balances to make sure they really do. And that's what we're talking about here. There's so many different ways that that system can fail, and ultimately, if it does, we could be back in a situation where the federal government has to come in and pay for these cleanups that were supposed to be the private industry's responsibility.
Why aren't the state boards that oversee this taking a harder line?
Well, the state regulators are in a tough position because, you know, states like Kentucky and West Virginia, they want their old mines to be cleaned up, but they also want coal jobs, and they want their coal companies to be healthy and profitable. And so oftentimes in the short term, there's really a trade-off there. If a coal company says, hey, listen, we need a little more time on this, or why don't you approve this deal so we can like keep all our guys at work, you know, that's very tempting to a state regulator. So sometimes the regulators have to weigh, on the one hand, like they want to support the industry, but that might kind of lead them to say, well, we'll think about reclamation, you know, as our second priority, or maybe we'll worry about that later. And so over time, that's part of the reason that they're kind of willing to approve these deals that separates the kind of profitable part of the industry from the cleanup obligations.
We'll talk about where things go from here when we come back.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
In Appalachia, there are any number of people who are taking it upon themselves to monitor this cleanup, to put pressure on mining companies to do it and to see what's being cleaned up and what's not. One of them you spoke to was a person called Junior Walk.
Junior grew up kind of in the heart of coal country along the Coal River, and there's a number of coal companies operating along there. He was affected by coal kind of starting out as a kid. His grandfather was a miner. He said he saw as a kid his grandfather welding little jack rocks, which is what coal miners would make, sort of little caltrops out of nails to throw in the way of coal trucks during labor disputes. And coal companies also hurt his drinking water when he was a kid. So, I mean, he grew up right in the middle of all this. And he now works for an organization called Coal River Mountain Watch. And he spends some of his days basically keeping an eye on, patrolling, keeping watch on the coal companies that operate around his childhood home and where he lives now. And one of the most effective ways he has for doing that is flying a drone. So he'll drive up, you know, he's got an old Subaru. We went and rode with him, and he sort of cowboys, you know, straight up these dirt roads up into these mountains and finds a spot. And him and his organization then report those violations to state regulators and, you know, try to get inspections or try to make sure that those companies stop doing that or make it right.
What does it look like in the area surrounding a spent mine?
Well, it's really a mix. I mean, you can be driving down a road or, you know, standing looking out down a ridge, and it can be really beautiful. West Virginia is a breathtakingly beautiful place. And then there could be right next to it what looks like a moonscape, just like scraped, not just to the ground, but like way, way below the ground, just gray rock.
You know, if you think about the mountain like a human body, that's like cutting your arm, right? It'll eventually heal back over. But if you're talking about a massive mountaintop removal operation, then that's like cutting your whole arm off. It's not going to grow back.
If we were to take a place like that you just described, what would a reclamation project look like? How would they bring it back? What steps would be involved in doing that?
I guess I'd give you an A scenario and a B scenario, according to some of the advocates we talked to. I mean, the A scenario of, you know, a perfect reclamation, which would be extraordinarily expensive, would be, you know, restoring the original contours of the land, bringing in, you know, deep topsoil, and then planting native vegetation that would take a long time to grow to the kind of level or height that it was before. That's very, very rarely done, except for some sort of, you know, PR projects or showpieces.
So a lot of these mines can become productive forest again, but it takes effort and time and money to do that. And a lot of the coal companies want to avoid putting that much effort in.
It's usually what's done when reclamation is done. There's kind of a very rough push of the landscape back into a topography that won't slide, you know, that won't fall apart in a rainstorm and slide down on somebody. And some dirt added to the top, and then mostly a sort of topsoil spray and grass seed spray added to the top, which can make pretty quickly some sort of chest-high grass through there. And then maybe an addition of some non-native species like a Russian olive or some kind of thorny, you know, not really that nice plants that are very hardy and grow really fast, and, you know, kind of provide the appearance pretty quickly of some vegetation there. But according to the people who live around there, don't really make a nice place to, you know, go for a walk or hunt for deer or, you know, do the sort of activities that they, you know, like to enjoy in the actual forests around there.
So just the bare minimum to keep it from becoming a mudslide forever.
That's the idea, right?
Yeah, so all the areas over there that look like a nice green meadow with no trees, that's all bare rock that has had hydro seed sprayed on it. And hydro seed is essentially grass seed mixed with fertilizer and like chopped up newspaper. And that'll grow on literally anything. It'll grow on a bare piece of rock. And that's what it's doing over there.
What happens from here? How, if at all, does this get fixed? I know it's a big question.
We don't really know. For the most part, the mines we're talking about have not been abandoned by their owners, right? There are still companies on paper that say they're responsible for these mines. They're just companies that are racking up a lot of violations, and it's kind of unclear whether they're ever going to have the money to do it. So if those companies fail, then typically the next step is, well, they have bonds that were posted at some point that money can be used to clean them up, but the bonds are often not enough. And as we reported, we're not even sure if the insurance companies that back those bonds will actually have the money. And then if there's still not enough money, then the states have funds that are backup funds that are supposed to be able to help out. But that whole system kind of wasn't set up envisioning a world in which coal was just ending.
And in the meantime, the people who live near these mines are having a rough go of it.
We've seen mines in our area that have been idled for nearly a decade. So they are not getting reclaimed, and they're also not producing coal. And as they sit, they create more pollution, have more erosion issues and other problems because they're not being maintained.
That's them doing everything to the letter of the law.
I don't think the news company's going to embarrass them enough that they would do anything. They're in the business to make money, not give it out.
You know, I look out at something like that and I think about my family, and I think about how certain members of my family have made a living, you know, never held down a 9-to-5 job in their entire lives, but just by going out in the woods and digging ginseng or digging bloodroot and yellow root and things like that. And I think about how much of that stuff was lost on a permit like that.
You could imagine that there just won't be enough money in those funds that are funded by coal taxes to pay for this kind of growing cleanup obligation with kind of falling coal revenue. And so then you're going to have to look to, you know, the state taxpayers or the federal taxpayers who ultimately will have to decide if they want to pitch in.
Jeff Saul and Zach Miter, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me.
Thanks, Wes.
Thank you.
You can read Zachary Miter and Josh Saul's reporting at Bloomberg.com. Thanks for listening to us here at The Big Take. It's a daily podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartRadio. For more shows from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen. Read today's story and subscribe to our daily newsletter at Bloomberg.com/Big Take. And we'd love to hear from you. Email us with questions or comments to BigTake@Bloomberg.net. The supervising producer of The Big Take is Vicky Bergolina. Our senior producer is Catherine Fink. Our producer is Rebecca Chasson. Our associate producer is Sam Gebauer. Raphael M. Seeley is our engineer. Original music by Leo Sidran. I'm Wes Kosova. We'll be back tomorrow with another Big Take.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.